Welcome to Diary of a High Net Worth Investor with me, Graham Rowan, Chairman of Beaufort Private Equity. Our community of almost 800 high net worth families in 37 countries have a unique set of opportunities, but also some significant challenges. In this show, we look at how to maximize the good stuff while managing the risks and the downsides. Who knows? We might even make investing feel like fun. My guest today describes himself as an ordinary bloke from Norwich who does a lot of stuff, makes a lot of mistakes, but has done okay overall. He's an ex-RAF pilot who quit flying after 8 years to become a full-time trader on the financial markets. It took 6 years to really learn his craft, so by necessity, he became a business owner so he could use the profits to support his trading. This has now morphed into a highly successful training company called The Realistic Trader, which now also includes crypto trading. He's an international speaker and the author of the highly acclaimed crypto book, How to Invest Safely in Bitcoin and Other Cryptocurrencies. Keen to capture his skills as a legacy for his two sons, in 2018 he wrote 400,000 words, which were then made into short video lessons as part of the Wealth Action Plan, a sort of Netflix for business and money. His name is Siam Kidd. Siam, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to see you again, Graham.
Now, in many ways, you're essentially a financial and a business educator, and I know education's at the core of your mission. What are the sort of shortcomings of the current education system that you're keen to rectify?
All of it. Let's just burn it all to the ground and start again. like when you look at budgeting, like if you look at zero-based budgeting in a business, so let's say you buy a brand new business, that's been fat with funding, or you know, you have lots of different departments that have their own little mini budgets, etc. Obviously, this is how the government works. It's like spend it or lose it. And so guess what? They spend it, and next year they spend more. And in business, like you should basically reward the most efficient department, you know, the one that doesn't spend as much, because that is a better capital allocator or resource allocator. So when you do, say, zero-based budgeting, you start, you know, using first principle thinking, going, right, to run this business or department, what exactly do we need? Like, to the penny. Okay, boom. Here's that. That is your budget. Maybe a bit of buffer. Yeah, I see no one doing this with the education world. So no one is literally taking, or no one in government, or no one meaningfully powerful, if that makes sense, is going, right, it's 2023. What is the world likely to be like over the next 40 years? Or hell, over the next 20 years even, because when AI breaches that singularity, we have literally no event what happens beyond that event horizon. So, you know, what's life going to be like over the next 20 years? Like, yeah, so schools are woefully and inadequately kneecapping our kids, I guess, because, you know, if you just take, ignore exponential growth of all tech, just say, let's take a linear incline over the next 10 years or so, we're going to have the world absolutely dominated and filled with AI or AI driven bipedal robots, because it's not just Tesla making the bipedal robots, there's many other companies out there, Figure, etc. They're going to basically destroy all manual labor type jobs. We've got the Tesla robot that's coming, Tesla robo taxi coming out. So full self-driving, like you can go in, fall asleep and arrive at your destination, that type of capability. So all driving jobs are gone. Is school equipping us for any of that? We have the financial world that's going to change. Like, yeah, just burn it to the ground.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not teaching anything practical like budgeting or how to start a business. And also, we've got the woke agenda to deal with. I saw recently two 14-year-old girls had written to the Minister of Education asking why they were being made to read books that tell them there are more than 60 genders. You know, you think, well, when did we vote for that? At what point did teachers and school governors think this is okay?
I know. I mean, putting on a tin hat here, it's almost as the it, like when you look at it, it's like, ah, imagine you're, you know, an adversary to the West, I don't know, China or Russia or whatever, and you're trying to think of the best possible way to neutralize and neuter your enemy over a 30-year period. Or wow. Just yeah, look at life exactly. Right now. It's like
I do perfect. Worry that we're kind of on the road to authoritarian Marxism. I think I used to be much more of a sort of cock up than conspiracy theorist, but I think since the things that happened during the pandemic, I have changed, and you do get the sense of some kind of agenda, but we're not quite sure who's driving it.
Yeah, control mechanisms everywhere you look.
Yeah, no,
from ESG to all the other topics, which I probably shouldn't talk about.
No, but I mean, just coming back to the education piece, I know it's something that's very close to your heart. And I think I saw something on the website for your school about how in a typical school day, kids only do about 30 minutes of active learning. So how far advanced are your own plans to form a school, and what kind of things would be on the curriculum for that?
Yeah, it's quite sad because I've had a bit of a personal financial dip over 2022, mainly because, you know, I'm very much tied in with crypto. So I still can't get the economics to work for my Per Ardua, my school. And the reason being is that when you start from scratch and you realize, right, what needs to happen? I mean, even from like basics, like what sort of nutrients are going into your children on a daily basis? All of a sudden, the food budget per kid is, you know, five times higher than a normal school. And so just the food budget alone is, it's crazy. So I can't figure out a way to get it economically viable without government support, whereas every other school out there has endless amounts of money coming in per year to, you know, to get it going. But I can't do it. The last economic sort of modeling I came up with, just to get an MVP for 15 kids, it's coming to close to 60 grand a month.
Mm.
I thought no one is going to spend, I don't know, $3,000-$4,000 a month to send their kid to an experimental school with just 15 kids.
So could some of it be done, just thinking about, you know, using technology and scale, could some of that be done in a similar way to the Wealth Action Plan with online videos and things?
I guess so, yeah. But then you're in a compromising exercise. So you have all of the, you know, the magic wand, this is what's ideal. And then before you know it, you're compromising on every ideal. And then it's a case of doing what I've just ended up doing with my kids, which is I've sent them to the best private school that I can find. Mm. So I'm trying to give them the best go, but all the key learning nuggets that I would like to impart on them, I'm doing myself at home.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I was going to ask about homeschooling. I know there's a guy in America called Tom Woods who's set up a kind of a parallel society, because I think they're all so fed up with what's going on in America at the moment. And part of that is a homeschooling that's based on things from Senator Paul, you know, Ron Paul, who's been a long-time libertarian advocate. And they're just more or less saying, look, you know, we're just opting out of the American school system because it's so bad. And we're doing a mixture of homeschooling ourselves plus these extra modules from that particular organization. So I suspect you might be pushing against an open door if you offered something similar in the UK.
I guess so, yeah. It's something which I will get there eventually, but ironically, it will probably succeed when my kids are too old for the school. The original plan was to get it up and running by the time the oldest one was four. He's now seven.
Well, I guess, you know, if you want to revolutionize the education system, it's not going to happen overnight, is it? And maybe it's something you shouldn't be just looking at on your own. You know, maybe it's something where you gather a group around you who buy into the philosophy, and then you've got a much more powerful framework on which to hang those kind of philosophies and ideas.
Agreed. Yeah.
Okay, let's turn to a different topic. I know you're an avowed atheist, but, you know, we're all kind of designed to worship something or someone. And I've heard you describe Elon Musk as your Lord and Savior. Why is he so important to you?
Oh, wow. Where do I start? I guess when you're investing in something, there's always a person at the helm, whether it's a company or a crypto or a stock or whatever. There's always someone there. And a track record, as in someone that actually fulfills what they say they're going to do, is one of the things I look for. And like you would with anything else. So a lot of people don't really know much about his past, as in his past businesses, and how, you know, he started with Zip. I mean, hell, he sold his first business when he was like 13 years old. It was like he sold a computer game to and then did some other bits and bobs. But he sold Zip2 for hundreds of millions. He then went and he set up X, which then merged into PayPal, sold that for billions, then went into obviously Tesla, and we know everything since. But he's not so one, although his ETA may be, you know, plus or minus 5 years, he does complete what he says he's going to do. And he's not just a car, he's not a car salesman. Like, he's all of his businesses touch the most important aspects of future human life. Everything from Neuralink. So, I mean, he says Neuralink's there to, you know, help paraplegics regain mobility and all that. But I think that's just the USP to sell it and get it off the ground. But I think Neuralink is just a way, as he says, to increase your output bandwidth, because we have sort of an Amazonian river worth of sort of input coming into us from, you know, TikTok, YouTube, internet, blah, blah, blah. But we can only output as fast as our little tippy-tappy fingers can tap on a keyboard or a phone screen. So Neuralink is a way just to massively expand that bar. And also, like, there are huge benefits of the metaverse. Now, and I mean, this is a whole nother podcast altogether, but the metaverse as we know it is not what Mark Zuckerberg is trying to do. You know, the metaverse is not where you put on these massive, you know, headset over your eyes, etc., and then, because you never feel completely immersed. I mean, every couple of years I buy the best VR headset that, you know, that I can get, and to be honest, they're all crap. Even still, that one behind me is a couple of grand and it's shit. And you're not ever going to get that full metaverse, you know, Ready Player One type, if you've seen the film. If you haven't watched the film Ready Player One, you need that with a neural implant. You just need something in your head that you flip, and then all of a sudden it's like reality, to the point where you don't know that, you know, everything is real. You can feel pain. It's like, so that is when the metaverse will explode. And then, I mean, we have what, a global GDP of, I don't know, God knows what it is, $250 trillion a year, whatever. Well, imagine the metaverse, just double it, quadruple it. I mean, how many universes would you like? So I think Neuralink plays a massive part in that. But going back to your question, why do I like him? I mean, because, yeah, Tesla is effectively 20 companies under one umbrella. So everything from tech to transport to, yeah.
But is it something to do with visionary thinking, or is he an amazing engineer that invents things? Or how is it that he's had, you know, such success in so many different sectors, from, you know, cars to space travel to robots to Neuralink? You know, it just seems to cover such a wide range, and yet he's that sort of common denominator in the middle.
Yeah, I think he's just got that nice balance, because he's not the best scientist in the world. He's not the best engineer in the world. But he's, you know, way up there, but he's got the business, you know, balls to back it up. So he knows how to raise money. And because he thinks like an engineer, because he is an engineer, he knows. So again, he starts with, you know, first principle thinking, you know, what is actually needed? What resources does it need? And then he has the ability and the know-how to go and raise that capital, to then go and raise the team to then actually do it. So a lot of people think, you know, he must be super busy with all of these businesses. And yes, he is. But ultimately, when you look at Neuralink, it's got how many hundreds or thousands of staff? That itself will be a pyramidal structure of a director, CFO, the whole C-suite. So obviously I don't know him, but he's probably just touching base with the key people at Neuralink once or twice a week, going, hit me, what's happening?
But don't you think there's something somewhat dystopian about this idea of putting a chip inside our heads that's it may give us access to a real metaverse, as you describe, but also, you know, it's a small step from what the World Economic Forum wants to do with us all, you know, to control us. So I'm not sure I'd be first in line to have a chip inside my head personally, but...
No. Like with any tech, you don't want the Mark One version in, do you?
Yeah, I think by the time the Mark II comes out, it might be too late for me, actually. But I'll keep my enthusiasm for that one under control. But I mean, another person I know that we share an admiration for is the late Christian business philosopher Jim Rohn, with his Art of Exceptional Living. What are the main lessons you've taken from Jim's teaching?
Oh, my Lord. Where to start? I listened to that book probably once a year. So, in fact, on YouTube, if you type in Jim Rohn, The Art of Exceptional Living, there is a 2-hour video presentation of him in 1981, just giving a seminar. And honestly, it's still timely and valid today as it was back then. He was talking about, you know, what's going to happen in the 1980s and 90s. And it's like, wow, you're spot on. I couldn't actually pick out any really good things. It's just a way of living. It's the way of thinking. The way I sort of, I have to sort of relate it into the way that I think. So I guess going back to sort of the military days, like, you always want to mitigate your surface attack area, if that makes sense. So same with like crypto security, etc. If you have crypto, you want your attack surface area to be as small as possible, instead of a big old sponge where you can be attacked everywhere. And it's the same with success and opportunity. You're not going to be a successful business owner or a lucky business owner if you have a very small luck surface area. So I call it my LSA, my luck surface area. So how do you increase your luck surface area? Well, you just need to do stuff. You need to get out there. You need to give things a go. You need to, you know, like the first 8 businesses I bought when I got into distressed mergers and acquisitions were total flops. So if you, you know, if you had a chat with me about my distressed acquisitions back in, I don't know, 2015, 2016 time, I would have been like, oh my God, I'm the worst business owner on the planet. I can't turn around a bloody, you know, packed lunch, let alone a business. But all of those failings have resulted into beautiful flowers, you know, 5-10 years down the road. So, yeah, actually, they're not mistakes. And hence my little neon thing here is, do fail, learn and pivot until you hit your goals. So doing more, getting out there more, increases your luck surface area.
Yeah, I guess, you know, in the middle of all that is being prepared to step outside your comfort zone, which I think comes back to education again, you know, and being willing to recognize that you've got to go through some pain to learn these lessons, though you can mitigate them by having the right people coaching you. And I know you do that a lot yourself through your own education programs. One of the things you've done a lot of recently is encouraging people to become business owners. I do wonder and worry about the political environment, particularly in the UK. You know, I don't feel that there's been a huge amount of support from successive, apparently conservative governments for entrepreneurs. Yeah. I mean, what's your take on the kind of the degree of government help, and would you like to see them doing more?
No, I don't give a shit, really. I think everyone needs to exit victim blame mentality. So you have to look at, you know, since humans have been around, what have been the norms? The norms have been politicians don't care about anyone other than being reelected. Therefore, governments don't give a shit about us. Taxes will always be too high. Inflation is always rampant. Why? Because politicians and economists will always print and expand the global currency supply. Therefore, prices will always be too high. You'll have megalomaniac, psychopathic billionaires that will always try to do what's possible to get more control. so like, there's a big list of things that are the norm. So I think you are absolutely barking mad to expect that list of things to change. If anything, it's going to be exacerbated in the world of internet, and, you know, finance is getting even smaller in terms of, you know, how quick things works now. So again, going back to first principle thinking, if you have this massive list of all the things that are technically hindering you, what must you do? What needs to happen for you to success in a future world where you don't need to worry about what politicians are doing? I'm not political. I just know that both parties are utter bastards, effectively. And whoever's in power, they're just puppets, because it's actually the ultimate control mechanism out there is really the Bank of International Settlements, the World Economic Forum, IMF is also up there. And they're the policy setters. And then the policy enforcers are the local governments. I mean, the UK government had how many prime ministers in the space of 5 months? The country still worked. It just goes to show that the prime minister actually doesn't mean anything, doesn't, you know, nothing, you know, we still got fed, we still got electricity. People are still going to work every day, regardless of who's the next puppet minister. So the way I look at it is it's never been easier in the whole of human history to set up a brand new business from scratch. Like, honestly, setting up a business right now in 2023 is easier than at any point in human history, especially with the absolute explosion of AI tools out there, which is completely disintermediating and just gobbling up all sorts of industries. Like, I can barely draw a stick, man, but I'm pretty sure I could set up a graphic design agency business right now and do better than most graphic designers, simply armed with all sorts of AI tools, from Midjourney to the generative fill function in Adobe Photoshop now. It's easy. In fact, I've actually just set up a brand new business just for shits and giggles, just to prove a point.
Well, as so, a graphic design company?
No, it's a bit different. My wife absolutely hates it. So so what I've been saying, so here's the preamble to this. Do you mind if I talk about this quickly?
No, go ahead.
I won't plug the website or anything. So over the last 10 years, or so from 2010 to 2020, the business model which worked an absolute treat was a B2C business that was a low price point, something like, you know, $10 a month, $30 a month type thing. So you have high volume, high margin, because it'll be online based. And then all you had to do is just do direct response ads. So Facebook marketing, Google, YouTube, etc. And the cost per acquisition from that marketing was so sublime that, you know, you could put £1 in at the top in Facebook and £3 would chuck out the bottom. So it was like, oh, great. So it was really easy to set up a subscription-based consumer business. 2020 changed everything completely. Apple and Facebook had a big old fight. So all of a sudden, the tracking of iOS users was not as good on Facebook. And therefore, Facebook ad costs just quadrupled overnight. I'll give you a real example. So the Wealth Action Plan, which you mentioned earlier, that's £30 per month. Now, historically, I could buy, technically, a new student for £90. So I'd be underwater for 3 months. And then, you know, as long as I do a good job, they're going to be with us however long. That then shot up to £300 to £400. So now, right now, if I did a Facebook ad campaign, it would cost me a good £300 to acquire a new customer. And then I thought, okay, am I the common denominator here? Fast forward now, I've employed 6 external Facebook marketing companies. They've all had the same thing. I once spent 15 grand in a single month to supposedly the world's best Facebook expert. No change. So it's crazy. And so what I've done recently is gone, okay, well, we're evidently in a new era now. Unless you're a celebrity and you already have millions of eyeballs on you, a B2C subscription-based type thing just won't work. So for an average Joe setting up now, or even an existing business owner that just wants to do something different, you know, what could you do? And so I thought, okay, it has to be business to business, because businesses are less price sensitive than consumers. We're all getting poorer, aren't we, with, you know, living costs, all that sort of stuff. But businesses are less price sensitive, especially if you just target a profitable business. So I know you could, at the very least, target businesses with 20 staff, so you know you got they've got the revenue. And then thinking, okay, well, I guess the best product would be a SaaS. Oh, my camera's stopped. Yeah, so SaaS, so software as a service, Or can you deliver a service using AI tools, but cheaper, faster, better, more efficiently, all that sort of stuff? Okay, so SaaS or a service using online tools, etc. High price point. So, well, I say high. I mean, you can start off at, say, $1,000 a month. And then, hell, you could just limit it to 30 clients. So obviously you can have a pricing structure, but let's just say you had, you're going to set up a B2B service-based business using AI tools to make it faster, quicker, cheaper. You could approach a company and say, hey, I can do X for £1,000 a month. You're currently spending $4,000 a month on your in-house, I don't know, whatever. Surely it's a no-brainer. No contracts or anything, so they can come and leave. And the thing is, if you do a B2B business with, you know, let's say you're legitimately going to cap it at 30 clients, no more. When you get to 30 clients, you'll then have a waiting list. So that adds, you know, that's good anyway. But $30,000 a month, so 30 clients paying $1,000 a month, that's 30K a month revenue. So it's 360K rev. Now, for that business model, you could easily sell that for 3 to 5 times rev. See, here's the thing. With a B2C type thing, it's really done on EBITDA. You know, probably 3 to 5 EBITDA or EBIT. There's no DA with an online-based biz. But with that type of B2B model, I said, you could easily sell it to a, 3 to 5 times rev. So all of a sudden, only 30 clients paying $1,000 a month, you could legitimately sell that for, I don't know, $1 million?
Well, yeah, $1 million plus, yeah.
Yeah. So let's go back to that graph. I'm not setting up a graphic design agency, but let's just use that as an example. You get a graphic design agency, you get 30 clients just paying $1,000 a month, which again is cheaper than an in-house graphic designer. Mm. You can actually source out the, you know, the legwork. You can get a couple of people on from Upwork, from other places. So existing graphic designers in, say, I don't know, Bangladesh or wherever, who are very keen to work hard, unlike British people. But you train and arm them with the latest cutting edge AI tools, they're just going to be way better. So I've already, you know, you could get two really well-trained graphic designers in the Far East that could easily service 30 clients. You've got some redundancy there, or hell, to get three of them. Still, it's not going to cost much. And then, I think then it's a case of who you're going to sell to. So I don't know, I could probably, let's say you have this graphic design firm, you can then just sell to an existing bigger marketing firm or an SEO company that would like to have that arm, as in the graphic design arm, or I don't know, a PR agency. And so it's a value add for them. Join our PR agency. We can also do all your graphics for a small markup.
Yeah. So I guess the whole AI thing is going to create a lot of opportunities. People tend to focus on the risks and the threats to existing skills, like the Hollywood screenwriters being on strike as we speak at the moment. But But I think a lot of it, and I know you spend a lot of time on this in the Wealth Action Plan program, a lot of it is about getting the business model right, isn't it? You know, because and as if you've just demonstrated, the economics of one model have now gone out the window, even though it used to work so well. But now you've got to do some research to find a new model that works in a sector where people will pay you that sort of money. And you can very quickly build a very valuable asset, even without being a subject matter expert yourself.
Yeah. And what I'd highly recommend is, like, let's say you take that new model, B2B, you know, service or SaaS, etc. And I think you should try and treat it. So a lot of people will try and do is be the doer, you know, and oh my God, I'm going to spend the next 3 months learning Adobe Photoshop or whatever. No. Treat it like a proper business. You are the director. So you're going to get other people to do the do in the Far East, let's say. You're going to get a UK account manager to be the, you know, the mouthpiece, the person connect, you know, liaising with your clients. And then that UK account manager, your, let's call it the ops manager, will be, yeah, client facing and tech people facing, servicing the thing. So you could easily have a two-man, two-person business, like really easily, that sells for a quick million.
So obviously loads of opportunities there. Now, obviously, in the early days for you, I think your businesses were supporting your trading, and then it sort of flipped to the point where trading became your biggest business.
For sure.
Looking ahead then over the next few years, do you see that continuing, or do you find yourself more excited by these new opportunities in business?
Yeah, I sort of, I don't cringe when I say I'm a business owner, because I spend all my days sat here in my underwear in this office, just looking at this, the screens. My money comes from trading. I do the businesses more for shits and giggles, and just why not? I think it's fun. For me, it's a bit like playing Monopoly. With Monopoly, what do? You go around the board, just buying up properties and getting those hotels. For me, I've got this internal plan. I play this game, the 5-9 game. And the 5-9 game, so first of all, the full business cycle is set up, run, grow, exit. There's four elements to a business. That is the full cycle, yet no one ever does the last bit. They set up, run, grow, or maybe not even the grow part, but they never exit. And most businesses end up with a small, weak whimper of a candlelight going out. So for many years, I've secretly done the 5-9 game. So I wanted to set up, run, grow, and sell a business for five figures, then do something else. Set up, run, grow, sell a business for six figures, seven figures, eight, and nine, just for shits and giggles to see if I can. So really what I'm trying to do now is do the eight figure exit. So, and I've got an idea what that is, but unfortunately, I'm just waiting for a few key texts, as in technologies, to get better, and then I can launch quickly. So that won't be for a while, but I'm in no rush.
Okay. So I know you've in the last 5 or 6 years done a lot of crypto trading, but I believe you have a very specific end date in mind when you want to come out of the market. Just explain what that date is and why you think it's so significant.
So it's the 1st of December, 2025. Without, because it's hard on the podcast, I'm going to have to use words as best as I can. So Bitcoin has these 4-year halvings. That's the only constant in a world of variables here. And as such, Bitcoin goes up for a year and a bit, down for a year and a bit, sideways for a year and a bit, and then it starts the new cycle. Now, so we have diminishing returns. So the all-time highs are a lot higher in terms of market cap, as in the amount of dollars in there, but percentage growth, it is shrinking. But every major thing in crypto or Bitcoin happens plus or minus 30 days from the 1st of December. So the all-time highs are always plus or minus 30 days within the 1st of December, normally around, you know, sort of 5 to 10 days within the 1st of December. And the low for that cycle is, again, plus or minus 30 days from the 1st of December. So where, if you could see this chart, we're halfway through that sideways accumulation zone, as I call it. And we, the halving is April 24th, as in 2024. But basically, on the bigger picture, it's up from now until December 2025, where I will sell everything, sit on my hands and observe, one, to see if my model is accurate. And I'm more than happy to, you know, take profit, actually. And then if I'm wrong and it just keeps on trundling up, okay, then I'll look for a re-entry. But the thing, what most people do in crypto is they never take profit. You know, everyone said, oh, I rode this coin from one penny to $10, but I then rode it all the way back down to 10, you know, one penny. So you've got to take.
I think you also have a slightly less hyped up view of where Bitcoin's price will get to by that point. I know some people are quoting $1 million. What do you see the peak being around December 25?
So the quick answer to that is $137,000. Which is probably the lowest you'll see on Twitter or YouTube, because I do see the, you know, $10 million Bitcoin, all that sort of stuff. And I get where they're coming from. I genuinely do, because, you know, if the US goes into big inflation / hyperinflation, then pick a number, 10 billion of Bitcoin doesn't really matter. Ultimately, what's happening in the world right now is what's happening to Argentina right now. So if you go back to the 90s, one Argentinian peso equaled $1. Then it depegged. It went to 3 pesos for the dollar, then 9, and then 12. Then it hovered around 12, 15 pesos to the dollar for a fair while. Now it's 350 pesos to the dollar. look at that chart. It's a parabola. It's a perfect exponential curve. And I called this in 2020 when I was and I was giving a proper case study of Argentina. It was 97 pesos to the dollar in 2020 or 2021. Can't remember. And I said we should hit 750 by 2025. I was massively underestimating it. We're already at 350. We're going to see north of 1,000 pesos a dollar by 2025. So when you look in hindsight, okay. By the way, what's happened is the whole of the middle class in Argentina has just been decimated, desecrated, evaporated, whatever word you can think of.
Yeah.
They don't exist.
Vaporized.
Yeah. You have dirt poor and billionaires left. That's basically what's left. And so imagine what the average wealthy, middle-class person, over the last 20 years would have done. They feel the purse being squeezed. So what do? They go to their financial advisor. What does their financial advisor say? Oh, it's fine. Just have a diversified portfolio of, uncorrelated assets. You'll be fine. And some have a nice structured portfolio as well. Some good old trackers here, blah, blah, blah. Every 2 years or so, go back to the IFA. Why am I still getting poorer? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's fine. Have your diversified portfolio. Well, all those IFAs have basically killed the middle class. But we now have hindsight, right? So if you were an Argentinian, transported back into the 1990s, 2000s, hell, the 20-teens, what should you have done? You should have borrowed as much as you can in the peso and then converted it into the dollar. If you're a business owner, take forward payments as much as you can, convert it into the dollar. You should have basically levered yourself up to the hilt in the peso, converted it into the dollar, knowing that we're not even in hyperinflation, we're just in big inflation at the moment. That's just going to erode away your debts. Now, the key thing, a load of business owners did do that, but what they didn't do is the critical last part, which is they stored their dollars in Argentinian banks. So guess what happens? The government goes, oh shit, all of our global debts are USD denominated, a dollar denominated debt, which means we need to repay other companies in dollars. Oh, we've run out of dollars. Oh, we're just going to pinch your dollars, Mr. Business Owner. Thanks for saving up for 20 years in dollars, whatever. And here's some pesos. Oh, and whoops, tomorrow we're just going to devalue the peso again. Yeah. So in hindsight, you need to store in the dollar and then store it in an offshore bank, right? Okay, Argentina right now is the world. Look at M2. So M2 is the currency supplier that everyone really looks at. No matter what country you're in, the currency supplier is an exponential growth. So what do we do now? We get levered up to the hilt in your local currency. So for me, pound sterling. You then convert it into Bitcoin or crypto, whatever. Let's just say Bitcoin, just to keep it simple. And you store that Bitcoin offshore. So not in a centralized exchange, in your own cold, hard wallet. So when big inflation comes in, you're golden. And Bitcoin Jesus, Michael Saylor, has always said, buy things that richer people will buy from you at any price in the future. Mm. So, when BlackRock and Fidelity and VanEck and all these big funds and banks start piling into Bitcoin, which they are already doing, they don't care if they're buying off you 100 grand of Bitcoin or a million of Bitcoin. They'll finally just completely pivot, just like The Big Short with Michael Burry. Mm. They were poo-pooing his subprime mortgage bond positions until they wanted in on the trade and they accepted any price when shit hit the fan. And guess what? BlackRock are now getting in on that trade. Vanguard are now getting in on that trade. The fact that the two biggest asset fund managers on the planet are now filing for spot Bitcoin and Ethereum ETFs means Bitcoin and Ethereum, at least, will be here for a freaking long time.
But then that begs the question, we just discussed why you want to basically sell up in December 25. Let's assume, your forecasts are accurate. It's around 138,000. You sell the Bitcoin at that point. What do you then go into to stay safe?
That's a really good question. So trading or investing in my brain, I have perpetual seesaws going on in my head. Like when I think of everything, there's a seesaw. What is going to outpace everything else? I don't look at assets in terms of the dollar or the pound, because that is a yardstick that's always just, it's a melting ice cube away. So I am constantly comparing crypto to the housing market, crypto to stocks, crypto to whatever. Now, let's say I'm right, and December 2025 is that nice Pico top, and we're in for some sort of retracement of some sort. The retracement will only be for a year or less. Okay. So it's a case of, do I sit in cash for a year, or do I just move into Tesla stock for a year? I mean, if you know, Elon is happy to store $300 billion worth of net worth in Tesla, or not Tesla, it's not just Tesla, but if he's happy to store $100 billion of his net worth in Tesla stock, it's good enough for him. I think it would be good enough for me, or Palantir, or you know, any other stocks that you may have an affinity with. But it's always, nothing is a set in stone thing. So yes, I will take profit. I'll finally buy Ellie the house that she's been wanting for 14 years. you know, there will be some form of profit taking there. And then you just have to reassess the charts and then get back in. But because of the spot ETFs and BlackRock, you know, that is their world, asset management. They won't want Bitcoin or Ethereum doing 1,000% growth and then 90% crashes and, you know, all that jagged whipsawing up and down. They'll want something that is predictable, that doesn't go too underwater. So I think they'll just flatten that curve as much as they can.
And that would make it less attractive to you from a trading perspective, I guess, because you volatility, I guess, is good for you.
Yeah. I mean, I never buy Bitcoin anyway. I just use it as a barometer. So if Bitcoin's going up, other asset classes will 10x, 5x as well. So it's a fine sweet spot. And so here's the thing, right? There is a premium that you pay for safety. So there, I'm going to be a big black tar brush here. I have acquaintances that are not wealthy, but they love crypto. They get it. They get the whole crypto. Everything I've just said, they're preaching to the choir, but they have no money. So their crypto pot will be like $500. So there's an element of sort of number anchoring here. So what they won't want to do is go and put that $500 into Bitcoin and get 0.02 of a Bitcoin. They'd rather buy something where they get 1,000 tokens or 1,000,000 tokens or whatever. And they're not looking for 30%, you know, CAGR. They're there to 100x their money in the shortest time frame possible. So what are they doing? They're dicking around in sub $10 million market cap crypto things that someone's just created out of their bedroom. No one knows about it, you know, and they're probably manipulating the price themselves. You know, it's not hard to manipulate prices. You could put money in a whole bunch of different wallets and buy and sell between yourself. So I won't touch tiny, teeny weeny crypto because that there's risk. There's risk of it just going to zero. I won't touch a $50 million market cap thing. So for me, because of I'm a small fry nobody from Norwich, but I won't touch anything less than $100 million market cap because I want some added security that is not going to go to zero overnight. At $100 million market cap, you know, it's got some substance. But the price I'm paying now, for $100 million market cap coin, you know, the coin is probably, let's say, $20, whereas the person dicking around at $10 million market cap, he got it for a penny or whatever. That's the premium I pay for safety. Now, take that same attitude and mentality, which is, it's the same going up as it is the way down. So there are fund managers out there sat on 50, you know, 50 million pounds or $500 billion. What is their premium that they're happy to pay for safety? At the moment, they're looking at Bitcoin going, oh, it's $400 billion asset. That's tiny. Not touching it until it's at least a trillion. Come back to me when it's a trillion. So when Bitcoin's a trillion, what's that? Bitcoin will be like back to 70K. So, you know, let's say they'll start buying it 100K upwards. Do they care? One, it's not their money, so they actually don't care. Two, they just want their bonuses at the end of the year. So they will happily buy it at any price, so long as they've got top cover. And can I just add one more thing to this? Sorry, I'm just vomiting over you here. So a prediction that I made a few years ago has come true last month. And I'm very happy about this because it's very bullish. Because I said that the elites, whoever they are, they'll criticize crypto relentlessly. It's bad. Only drug dealers want it, blah, blah, blah. And then I said at some point, institutions will come in and try and get spot ETFs launched so they can try and control this a bit more, which we've seen happening. That's fine. And big firms will start changing their tune about the ESG element of it. So they've been, you know, basically shitting down on Bitcoin, saying it's the worst energy polluter on the planet. It's just it's irrelevant, blah, blah, blah. Well, guess what happened in August this year? KPMG, one of the biggest firms that every company uses to tax advice and all that sort of stuff, have issued a report, and I can send you the link, all of a sudden saying Bitcoin is absolutely essential for ESG. It's going to innovate the world into green energy. And if anything, will be a negative carbon, not carbon neutral, carbon negative, because it will help extract methane, which is... So, and also, they said that Bitcoin is not used for illicit purposes. Only 0.24% is used for illicit purposes.
And how long have you and I known that?
Oh, yeah, years, right? We've been saying this from the rooftops. But guess what? That all these big firms will now lean on top of that KPMG. That's top cover. So it's a case of, you know, someone complains, why'd you go into Bitcoin? Well, BlackRock, Fidelity, Vanguard, State Street, they're all getting into it. And KPMG, nice reputable firm, said it's great for ESG. So it ticks all of the bullshit ESG boxes.
So when, I mean, we need one more prediction from you. And when will the SEC actually approve these spot ETFs?
I'm going to give a cop-out answer. Within 12 months.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, yeah, I think that's the way it's going, isn't it? You can almost see this sort of a slow motion plan unfolding, can't you? But I was quite surprised. When we first met over a decade ago, you were a gold bullion dealer.
Yes.
And yeah. I was surprised you never mentioned the yellow metal when we talked about, you know, being safe after selling crypto. What's your thoughts on gold?
So I love the concept behind gold. But I have to look at the numbers. And when you seesaw gold against anything else, it hasn't done very well since 2010. I put it this way. I sold nearly all of my gold and silver in 2021. And I made a 350% ROI. And I told my friends, I sold all my silver, gold, blah, blah, blah. I only got 350%. And they're like, what? That's amazing. And I was like, no. I've held my gold and silver since 2009. So when you look at the annualized returns, it's like, let's call it 12 years, really. So 350 divided by 12, I've only made 29.16% ROI per year. When you account for real inflation, as in the currency expansion, I've really done bugger all. So I'm not too happy about that. Bitcoin has all of the pros of gold, none of the cons of gold. So, yeah, the only way gold has any real price appreciation at this point is if a government comes along, no, sorry, a central bank comes along and backs a percentage of the currency supply by gold.
Yeah, and of course we've got the whole emerging BRICS countries that have a lot of gold in their vaults and their central banks. So I think for me, I don't see gold necessarily as something I'm consciously trying to make money on. I see it more as trying to preserve wealth, you know, that it'll simply be more and more of this useless paper fiat stuff to buy an ounce of gold. So it's more a wealth preservation strategy than a sort of a trading to make a profit strategy, somewhat different, I think.
I get that. But if you just take gold from, say, 2011 till now, it's done zero price appreciation. So it's done what's called a silent crash. I've got a chart here. In August 2011, the price of gold was $1,900. Right now, it's September 2011, 2023, it's now $1,900 or $1,924. So prices on zero. If you then look at US M2 from 2011 till now, I'm just getting the chart up, stand by over. 2011, here we go. So sorry for listeners, you can't see this, but I'll tell you the figure in a second. Since 2011, the US currency supply has grown 137%. So if you've had gold, you're minus 137% in 13 years. It's not a store of wealth.
Okay. Well, yeah, I guess it's for me, it's probably the best house in a bad neighborhood. Put it
true,
that way.
Yeah, yeah, that I concede. Yeah,
yeah. So I think it has a place, but I think the startling thing really is the constant increasing in the money supply. Obviously, the pandemic saw the Fed's balance sheet go about six times or something. I mean, where does this all end? I look at Joe Biden's spending commitments and I look at the declining tax take, and I think, you know, sooner or later, I mean, there's going to be a train crash, but I don't know. We've been saying this for probably the best part of a decade, and somehow they keep kicking the can down the road. I mean,
the crash in 2020.
Yeah, briefly, yeah, okay. But you know, now the governments are making big renewed spending commitments. It looks like we're just constantly going to live beyond our means at a national level, and no politicians have got the cojones to do anything about it. So, you know, it's exactly what you said about Argentina. That is effectively the canary in the coal mine for the rest of the planet, isn't it?
Yeah. Just coincidentally, or not coincidentally, I just checked. So gold, since 1990, I'm just trying to find a round figure. So 1990 till now, so that's 33 years, it's only gone up 411%. US M2, in that same time period, has gone up 559%. Mm. So even over the last 33 years, gold hasn't actually outpaced inflation. Mm. So yeah, it was my realization of that. I was thinking, oh, actually, maybe I should be looking at adding something else on the seesaw. But yeah, it's the best house of a bad neighborhood, as you said.
Yeah, and I suppose what scares me, and I meet our own members every day who've got £500,000, £600,000, £700,000, £800,000 sitting in high street bank accounts, you know, and you think, you know, you've lost six figures of purchasing power this year alone, you know, because we all know how manipulated the government inflation figures are. So, you know, the real inflation is probably at least double that. So, you know, people think they're doing the smart, safe option, keeping a whole load of cash, but it just loses value so fast.
Yeah, it is holding a melting ice cube in the Sahara Desert. And it'll get worse.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it'll get worse when CBDCs are fully disseminated into the public.
Do you see that? Is that their way out from the inevitable financial crash? Are they just going to do a great big reset where we suddenly have even more worthless digital currency instead of the paper stuff?
Yeah. So CBDCs are not there against Bitcoin or crypto. CBDCs are there to take out fiat currency, as in cash. It's the war against cash. That's what CBDCs do. So you look at all of the control mechanisms that the Chinese government have over the populace. The West is looking over there going, "Ooh, we want some of that. How can we do that?" Well, you can't do that until everyone is using a CBDC, which is a programmable money. Now, if you, again, look at, I mean, I'm not Nostradamus here. This is obvious, just projections here. Over the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to have mass, like ridiculous job loss from, you know, AI and robots, smart driving, bipedal robots, everything, right? The world will have to start giving out UBI, universal basic income. Now, UBI, I think in most countries will just replace the welfare, because everyone says, where are you going to fund it from? Or if you just cut welfare as it is now and just have UBI, it's fairer, more efficient, etc. So every adult gets £600 a month just to live. I don't know, something like that. It's very easy to find where that comes from, as in how you can actually finance that. But the beauty of it is that it's all programmable. So you will only get it if you're a good citizen. So you will only get it if you're double jabbed. You'll only get it if you know, whenever there's the next, you know, climate lockdown, they will do. Yeah. So for example, if they want to do a climate lockdown, at the moment, they can't do it. But with programmable money, CBDCs, they can, because your wallet or your cash just won't work half a mile from your house. So if there's a lockdown and you leave, let's say, half a mile from your house or more, your money won't work and the authorities will be alerted that you've left your perimeter. It's a very snazzy citizens' house arrest that the public just will be completely oblivious to.
Yeah, indeed. That's kind of the way I see it going. So financial education becomes even more important for the masses. Now, we're coming to the end of our time together, Siam, and yeah. Every time I meet you, there's always some big new thing you're planning. So I want to try and find out what's next for Siam Kid. What's the next adventure?
I've got a few things. I've got, you know, what, six companies at the moment, so they're all doing little bits and bobs. But I guess the next big thing is, so I've got, my camera's turned off again. As you know, I've got a crypto private equity firm, so to speak. So hopefully we should see all of that finished soon or during this next bull market. But the proper big business I want to set up, or no, bigger business. So this is for the eight-figure exit thing. And I've been saying this for about 5 years now, but I'm just waiting for tech. I would like to buy as many Teslas as I can. So at some point, there's going to be the new mass market Tesla. So they've been saying that, you know, over the next few years, there'll be a robo-taxi specific model, you know, maybe a two or four seater thing. It won't have a steering wheel. It'll be dirt cheap. It'll be like £20,000 to buy, etc. Well, what I've worked out is that, let's take Norwich. I've never left Norwich, really. I could buy 1,000 robo-taxis for Norwich. The responsivity will be better than Uber. And I can dictate what the mileage will be. So if you take the average taxi fare, it's like £12.50, and they only drive about, you know, 3 miles on average. Well, with my taxi robots, I could charge 50p a mile. So the taxi fare will then go from £12.50 down to £1.50. Each car will have some sort of full self-driving subscription. I think he'll probably charge, I don't know, £300-£500 a month per car. But when you do the maths, it's a wildly profitable thing. So you can spend. So even Elon himself has said that each car, if it was a dedicated robo taxi, would generate between $20,000 to $30,000 of revenue. Obviously, it depends how much you charge per mile. But I've done the numbers. Charging 50p a mile is still wildly profitable. And so when you look at the yield, it's like, wait a minute. Let's say I can make 15 grand a year per car, and it's only costing 20 grand, or one, I won't have to buy all up front. You know, I can finance some of that. So the actual return on real money invested is already profitable from day one. And then you're effectively break even in 18 months max. Maybe two, let's say I'm really, really wrong, 3 years. Okay. How long is the car going to last? The car's going to last at least 10 to 20 years. We have Teslas driving, old Teslas driving around with north of 1 million miles now. So, and all the Teslas I've had in the past, they've never let me down. Like my old super fast one, I did 60,000 hard miles on that. I still had the same brake pads. Just crazy. And the family version, the Model X, that's been going, well, I don't know, 70,000 miles now. Same brake pads, same everything. So I think, instead of buying to let for houses, I'll be buying to let, but for robot cars.
Okay. Well, it'll be fun to see that. So I think, as you say, we're not quite there with the technology yet. I don't particularly want to be too close to the non-driver cars at the moment, but it sounds like an interesting plan for the future. And again, it's all based on that business model thinking that we talked about earlier. So some great ideas there and some great input. So Siam Kid, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, no, thank you. Cheers, Graham.
Thanks for listening. If you qualify as a high net worth investor because you earn more than £100,000 a year, or you have an investment portfolio of £250,000 or more outside your main home and pension, you can join our investor community free of charge at beaufortprivateequity.com.